Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 55, titled Three Luminosities.
So then, okay, now I have not had, Dale says I'm a professor, and so I do profess something, which is the Buddha Dharma, because I do have a sense of refuge in the Buddha Dharma. And although in Buddhism, when one takes a refuge, one says one takes refuge in the three jewels: Buddha, the teacher, Dharma, the teaching, and the reality that is taught. Dharma has actually 11 meanings, they say, but those are the two most important ones. And Sangha means the community of those trying to understand and live in that teaching. Sangha. So we are temporary Sangha here, community. And but of those three refuges, the real one is Dharma. The great masters all say, because Dharma is reality. In other words, and this is the great good news of the Buddha teaching, is that, and this is the real essence of the Buddha's discovery, you could say, is Buddha's discovery was not at all the discovery of suffering. That's completely a mistake. People think that because that's the first of the noble truths. But as I often say, any idiot can discover suffering. You definitely don't have to be a Buddha to stub your toe or to lose your boyfriend or your girlfriend or your child or your parent or your lover or whatever it is, or your life. You know, you can suffer. Everyone suffers. Buddha's in discovery was the freedom from suffering. Nirvana, that was his discovery, which people are never really sure there is such a thing, especially people who suffer, who are suffering. They think maybe that's all there is to it, or they maybe have an idea that somewhere after death, maybe God will help them, put them up in the choir where they'll be in the bliss of heaven, or maybe after they die they'll go off to some nirvana, or if they've meditated a lot, or maybe they'll go with Krishna or something. But actually, it's something people are not sure of, and definitely in our modern culture, we are told there is no escape from suffering, but we are told that is palliated, that statement is palliated for us by the assurance we are given that the worst that happens is we simply cease to exist, which is a kind of freedom for suffering. It's sort of why the materialist masses, I mean philosophically material, I don't mean like Madonna, the mall goers, I mean the philosophical materialist masses, the ones who think they will not live after death, they will not exist after their brain stops, are not that interested in nirvana because they assume that the worst that can happen to them is anesthesia. And then if they're having a good time, they're kind of afraid to not continue having a good time. But they seek that anesthesia, of course, as we know, we all seek anesthesia when we have pain. But Buddha's discovery was that reality itself is joy and bliss. It's funny, Dale, I often am accused of making light of death when I try to cheer people up in funerals. It's just something I often do. And I'm occasionally asked to speak in funerals, usually by people who don't have an idea of what I'm going to say. And what I often do, I'm almost invariably the only person I'm really interested in talking to in funeral. I mean, there's the bereaved, of course, that one wants to console and give hugs to and so on. Although joining them in sniveling, I don't think really helps them much, because they basically think that you can't possibly be as sad as they are, and they're right. But the person that I talk to in funerals is the departed one, who's around. According to how I see the process of life and death. And in fact, in the Book of the Dead, one of the things they warn you, after you die, be careful, because you automatically become 9 times more intelligent than when your mind was trapped in your plaque-infested brain and you were forgetting everybody's name. When the mind pattern is like in a subtle energy hologram apart from the brain, because of you having been a human being and having a supercomputer that you are, that you have possession of, the structure of your consciousness, you're automatically 9 times more intelligent, which means, and one of the things they say about it is, the higher human intelligence is automatically clairvoyant. That is, when we have like vague intuitions, you know, from people's facial expression or from knowing them or something, we kind of have a sense we can think what someone is thinking, you know. But if you develop your natural human powers, you can actually really hear people's thoughts. It's easy to do, supposedly. In fact, in meditation teachings of all forms of Buddhism and Hinduism, they tell you that when you become a little bit adept at meditating, you will start being clairvoyant. And don't be distracted by other people's confusions. You have enough of your own still. So don't start playing around by being clairvoyant, in other words. You know, and go and become a fortune teller, you know. But when you die, they say, because of this, you will tend to be going present. You will be attracted to where your body was before, to the ones you loved before in the between state, when you're not yet headed for a new embodiment and you're not in the floating in the clear light, in the luminosity that is the ideal way of traversing the death traverse, at least for some time. And so then you're back at your funeral. And then they say, if Uncle Joe is doing a eulogy to you at your funeral and saying, oh, poor Bob, you know, like he died so bad, oh, I'm so missing him already, and this isn't that. And then you can read his mind, and he's thinking underneath, good riddance, I don't have to argue with him next Thanksgiving. And I'm tired of him, like, bumping my fender when he gets out of the parking lot, and many things. Because everybody has multiple levels and channels in their mind, and you're just not used to hearing them, and you become aware of them. Don't be angry with Uncle Joe. He is also sorry that you died. He has mixed feelings. Everybody does. So be cool and be loving and be happy, because that's what's important for you in your between state and not judging other people. So they warn you that you know, there's a warning about it. So I forgot why I got into that. But yes, the death process. So in the Buddhist view, in the Buddhist, you could call it Abhidharma, but you know, the Mahayana and Vajrayana don't call their technical treatises Abhidharma anymore. They sort of leave that to the Theravada. There's only one book called Mahayana Abhidharma, but there are many shastras or technical treatises that are technically really Abhidharma, of the non-dual Mahayana and also the Vajrayana. And in a way, the Book of the Dead is a product of Buddhist sort of systematic or scientific treatise, and which is to say, people who died, who performed what's called lucid dying, like you all know the expression lucid dreaming, where people can train themselves, or sometimes it happens spontaneously where you're having a dream, and then you suddenly know you're in a dream, but you don't wake up. You can stay in the dream, and then you have a different relationship to your experiences in the dream, because it's called lucid dreaming, right? And it's a yoga, actually, and it's something that ancient time they trained themselves to do, to use the dream state to learn more things and to develop their practice and so on purpose. And also actually to rehearse the after-death state, because the after-death, the between state, as I call it, I don't like the expression intermediate state. It sounds like intermediate, you know, volleyball or something, you know. So the between state, the word bardo simply means a between, a gap, you know. So the between state is like a dream state. So lucid dreaming is a good way to train yourself to be conscious in the trajectory between death and choosing a rebirth, should you decide to choose a rebirth in the human plane or in whatever plane. And if you're not just driven by instincts as an enlightened person is, but you have some conscious control. So in those things, it is said that our normal sense of identity and our sense of boundariedness where we live in the fear of death, although often in denial that that's what we're living in the fear of. Most often, actually, ordinary person is in very much denial about it. But when we do, we are living in what's called our coarse body mind. We are identifying with ourselves as what they call the coarse body mind. And that the coarse body, sometimes they call it the flesh and blood body, flesh and blood and bone body. Sometimes they call it the sixth sense organ body, which is therefore most of our conscious time is spent reacting to stimuli of the five senses, five external senses, and then the inner mental sense, which works usually in coordination with the five external senses, or can work in an inner mental realm with the imagination, you know, where you have an image in your mind of some person or a place or a happening, you know, when you're in either memory or of the past or fantasy or anticipation of the future. And so that's the coarse body mind. The coarse mind is that sixfold consciousness. The coarse body is the sense organ body. Then there's something they call the subtle body mind. And the subtle body mind is where the subtle body is the neural system. And they call it the channels, winds, and drops. And that's the famous chakra system people have heard about, I'm sure. That's different, the brain chakra, throat chakra, heart chakra, navel chakra, genital chakra. Sometimes there's a few extra ones spinning off here and there. But those are the five usual ones. And then there are many channels, nerve channels, energy channels, between those nexuses, which are like wheels or lotuses in those five levels. And then there are energies, which are literally called winds, moving energies that circulate in that neural structure. And then there are drops, as they call it, which we might call neurotransmitters or hormones or something. There's fluid substances that circulate in those drops. And that's considered the subtle body. And then the subtle mind is three luminosities, actually, where you have one of them is experienced as being in a luminous space that is like moonlit space. One is that thousand million suns, brilliant sun space, and one is a dark space. So there's this white, red, and black, three levels of the mind. And, you know, like when the hippies got stoned in the 60s, and including myself, and they saw the white light, they were not seeing necessarily the clear light. They were seeing that first level of the subtle mind, which is the moonlit light. According to these reports of people who lucidly died and then reported on what the phenomenology of the dying was, which is what the so-called Book of the Dead or Book of Natural Liberation comes from. And then there's the super subtle body mind, which is the one, I think, that where you can really rest. Although those layers of luminosity are quite restful in themselves in a way, although the unenlightened person often doesn't recognize them, because the unenlightened person has so many instinctual surges when they get into a space where they're not completely invested in their sense organs, where they're used to being active, you know, and responding to stimuli and constantly maneuvering their sort of perimetered being in an environment that is other than them. And so then they're used to sort of surging around and restlessly like that. So there's said to be 80 instincts in those three mental realms of the moonlit, sunlit, and darklit. There's 80 instincts in there. And they sort of cause you to kind of, you know, shift restlessly around at an instinct level, although you don't have the ordinary body. You don't have a sense, you don't identify with yourself as being an ordinary body in that time. So then the real resting place in this phenomenology is the clear light, transparency, which is said to be not a bright moonlight or a bright sunlight or a bright black light, but it's said to be a grayish light like a glass or transparent, like a diamond, but of course not with a light that has no opposite of darkness, put it that way. So the analogy for it, it's an inconceivability, of course, but the analogy for it is a pre-dawn twilight, something like that. Not a bright thing. But it's very restful. And then again, it's something, matter and mind, the body and mind, the energy, that the subtle energy the holographic subtle energy, which at that point almost the holograph melts because there's no more chakras and things. So whatever it is, one doesn't know. But that energy and the consciousness of the clear light, transparency, is sort of, when you think of sort of reducing to it, you think of it as entering a sort of super point, like almost disappearing into it, melting into it. But then the clear light is everything. That's what, then it becomes inexpressible, because it is everything. So it is infinite, an infinite presence. It's like you are the transparency of everything, so you are everybody else. And to be conscious at that super subtle level is to be a Buddha, they say. And that also is what is referred to as the Buddha nature, etc. And so you can't even say what it is, really. But in a structure like that, which is useful for someone to navigate it, to have a sense of a roadmap to navigate it, then it seems to be like as if a point of where you melt. And actually, when you hit that, when the ordinary person hits that, even though they don't know that they necessarily hit it, that's the definition of death, actually, the death point, what's called the death point. But like a point or a line which has no width and a point which has no size, in a way, it doesn't. It's not there. It's just a sort of transition. It's a doorway in that sense, because then the person immediately wants to come back up to where they feel the sense of self-definition, and then they get reborn, unless you're a Buddha. And then what is interesting about it, though, is that every night when you fall asleep, you go through that same process. And actually, this brings me to, you know, we're not quite yet ready, but we will soon be ready to adjourn, to rest, because you've all traveled and everything. But to the special sleep yoga of Menla, which I want to share with everybody. It's the sleep yoga. How you sleep here at Menla, okay, in case you like to try it. And the sleep yoga of Menla is actually very appropriate for dealing with this topic, because what it is you initially you make a critique in your mind and you say, okay, when I sleep, I usually turn out all the lights, put in earplugs if I'm in a noisy place. Of course, I close and lock the door, etc. I get the right ventilation, the right temperature, the covers, the pillow. I get all cozy. And then I let go of my sense of holding onto my boundary. I do. And I'm looking for rest, actually. And I want to become unconscious. But I associate what I'm taught as the reality view of this materialist culture of ours, where I went to all these science classes. Maybe I went to Harvard and went to a natural science course in the core curriculum and was told by some high authority of a Nobel Prize winner that he was sure I didn't exist after death. And the religion was like confused and an old superstition. And so we associate that state of being in darkness with the nothingness that we expect at death. On some, even if we have a belief in reincarnation, or if we have a belief in the soul, or if we're Christians, or Muslims, or Jews, or whatever, our sort of common sense, consensual belief of our reality is that we will be nothing, actually. Unfortunately, that is, we are all educated people, and that's what we, even after years of looking at the other thing, unless you have had a memory of a previous life or something, you sort of feel that, well, that's what they say, but that's what it is, that's real. You know, we a little bit, unfortunately, have refuge in that. So the sleep yoga is you critique that ahead of time and you say, wait a minute, if the darkness in which I sleep and the lack of light because my eyes are closed, if I'm subconsciously associating that with the sleep of death, for in that sleep of death, right, Hamlet, right, for in that sleep of death when we have shuffled off this mortal coil, what dreams may come must give us pause, right? Remember that famous thing in the Hamlet. And you critique that and you say, no, I'm at Menla and I'm going to experiment with the phenomenology of the Book of the Dead. So beneath the level of the dark lit, that is the lowest level of the three levels of the subtle mind, of moonlit, sunlit, and dark lit, beneath that is the clear lit space. And what that space is, why that's restful, is that it's infinite energy. And it connects beautifully to the zero quantum vacuum energy field, which is supposed to be nothing there, but yet mathematically it has infinite energy. The quantum people are scratching their heads.
Is this a new thing?
What?
Is that a new discovery?
Yeah, something. Well, it's something that they play around with. You know, they're theoretical quantum people. But that's a clear light of the void. And it is an infinite energy. And that's why I feel rested in the morning. If you were lying in nothingness, dark nothingness, why would you feel more rested in the morning? Oh, give me a break. Where would that new energy that you feel when you ride the old rock and go see Dale Borglum and do your yoga and do whatever, where would that zest that you have in the morning come from? Actually, when your brain gets out of the way, your cells naturally melt into the bliss, the infinite bliss of the clear light of the void, of near, which you could call nirvana, which you could call the refuge of the reality, the bliss reality that Buddha discovered, the nirvanic reality that Buddha discovered. Why he was a happy camper, the Buddha, a joyful person. So that's the yoga. So as you're falling asleep and you're letting go of your conscious mind and you're just trusting the pillow and the bed and the door and the window and the temperature and everything, and to turn out the lights, you sort of just project in your mind that I'm going to be bathed and I'm going to be received in the clear light of the void. So that when I wake, I will be re-energized, you know. It's like the Borg, you know. you know, remember the Borg? Are you Star Trek people?
Resistance is futile.
What?
Resistance is futile.
That's right. Resistance is futile. You will be assimilated. And you remember when Captain Picard was inducted into the Borg, he would go stand at night and sitting that thing, you know, and then they would be energized in the Borg or whatever, the sleeping station. Remember that? So luckily you don't have to go and have stuff plugged into your brain and everything, because clear light is more powerful. It doesn't need to have like fixtures. It doesn't need to have iPhone type charging cords. It's just because it's everywhere. And actually, you mentioned Vajrayana Dale, but in the Buddha's most esoteric and most advanced teaching, everything is made of that clear light. So your body itself, your health in your own body. Why do cells like to stay together in your hand? Because they like each other. They like not boundarying against one another. They're interrelating. And they are very happy with it. They like each other. You know, your body holds together. Your health is the joy and bliss in your body, actually. According to Buddha's view. He didn't say that, though, at first. To those Brahmin males who he taught the original sort of dualistic Buddhist thing about, oh, yeah, I know you guys are suffering, and you're out there seeking some sort of final solution and freedom. And yeah, there is such a thing. And I know you would, if I told you that you were in it right now, you would like have me arrested. As you know, bliss and joy are illegal in most cultures. You realize that? Pretty much. And if Buddha had said, oh, bliss, I've discovered bliss to everybody, I don't think he would have gotten so far. So he just said nirvana means the extinction of suffering. So then, okay, anesthesia, people are cool with that. That's fine. But actually, it's bliss. It's the free. It's beyond the extinction of suffering. It's bliss. So okay. So that's the sleep yoga. So just try to remember that. There's the coarse body mind, which is now this waking thing. Then there's the subtle body mind, which is the three light spaces with no sense of a separated body, except super subtle. But then, because of the 80 instinctual surges that usually prevent a person from just resting in the moonlight or the sunlight or the dark light. Sunlight is, you know, you wouldn't be able to sleep very well. It's a little too bright. It is 100,000 million suns, very, very bright. That's why people seek the dark light, actually. A little more subtle, a little more quiet. And there are only 7 instincts in there. But then your rising in your dream is where your mind feels uncomfortable being just merged with things in the subtle body mind level, and doesn't even entertain a notion usually of the clear light level, where you're one with all beings and all Buddhas. So then the dream is where you're conjuring up a new sense of separateness of yourself and the environment, the dream environment in which you're navigating or having like a pleasant dream or an unpleasant one. And you're reproducing your daytime experience in some form, but learning something from it, even unconsciously. And if you learn to lucidly dream, you can learn a lot more from it. So that's the sleep yoga of Menla, okay? You got that? And I should say about Menla, maybe last thing, and for this introductory thing, and then we'll stop. I should say about Menla that Menla means medicine Buddha. It is this blue Buddha, because Buddha, and that is Shakyamuni, and he was inspired by those seven Buddhas above, which are medicine Buddhas, has a whole legend. They come from another universe. They particularly appreciate Shakyamuni Buddha among the thousand Buddhas that will grace this planet over during its long history. He's the fourth one. And he picked the time when we are having the hardest time on the planet, where there's a lot of war and violence. We only live 100 years maximum, more or less, except for an exceptional person, and often less. But we're very dissatisfied, and we have a hard time. So he came as a Buddha in that time, and therefore the medicine Buddhas felt sorry for him. So they came and they inspired him to be medicine Buddha. And they said they would bring knowledge of medicine, because otherwise the human beings in this era would be too sick all the time to be able to practice the Dharma. They'd all be worrying about their sickness, and they couldn't. So medicine Buddhas came and taught that. And when he teaches that medicine Buddha, which is therefore the sort of inspiration of this particular place, the people who hear him, he creates a field around himself, they say, the medicine Buddha, where everything suddenly appears as medicine. That's what's nice about it, why it inspires us here at Menla. In the sense that, you know, normally we worry it's too cold, I'll catch cold, or it's too hot, I'll get indigestion, or there's germs and I'll get that, or there's a bear, or there's a bug or something. So we're kind of nervous about what might come at us from the environment. But when you're in the vision of the medicine Buddha, everything is healing. It's a matter of the sense of connection to it and the knowledge about it, so that you take the right amount or you avoid this one for the time. You don't mix this one with that one. So there's a knowledge thing that is required to exploit the healingness of everything. But it's a vision of reality as basically really kind and good to you, unlike a frightened kind of vision of reality. So that's the inspiration of this Menla. You're in Menla, medicine Buddha. Okay? So that's all I want to say tonight. All right?
All right.
All right. And tomorrow morning, Dale, you'll be in the hands, good hands of Dale.
It's 9:30.
And I will try to catch up. I have some stuff I have to do in the morning. Then I will be with you at 4 p.m. And then we'll be together again in the evening. All right?
Should there be any meditation?
And why don't you lead us in the final meditation, and please try to do the sleep meditation. What?
Should there be some meditation included in the program?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, a whole session can be all meditation. Now, I'm going to definitely meditate before.
Okay.
I'm going to lead some meditation, not just talk all the time. I couldn't think of what to say all the time if I talk. Or I would start doing comedy.
I'll bet you could.
I start getting into the comic, actually. I'd like to. But yes, and we, of course, will meditate. But then I've given you the meditation of the sleep meditation, sleep yoga. Because, you know, we do sleep one third of the day, right, if we get the 8 hours. And since we are human beings, and since if we develop what is called a realistic worldview, the first of the Eightfold Path, you know, of Four Noble Truths, those of you who are familiar with that, the first branch is not meditation. The first branch is called realistic worldview. And strangely, that realistic worldview doesn't mean you believe in nirvana, doesn't mean you have to believe in Buddha, doesn't mean that. But what it means is you should believe in causality. And Buddha's whole essence of the thing was the discovering causality. Ye dharma hetu prabhavad, I mean, I can recite a verse. But that's a very interesting thing if you think of what that means. That means causality means everything is interconnected in a causal process, karma, you know. It means that our sense of ourself as something separate from all interrelatedness is a neurotic delusion. And actually everything about us is totally interconnected with every other thing. It's sort of the beginning of groping our way back out of that sense of isolated, absolute, separate self that is the source of our suffering, according to Buddha's analysis. is psychological analysis, scientific analysis. But we'll talk more about that tomorrow. Okay? Thank you very much. And thank you, Dale.
Thank you.
I like that. I was very happy. I learned a lot from that.